This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Don Byron is a composer and clarinetist who is full of surprises. Early in his career, many listeners were surprised to hear an African-American playing klezmer music. At a recent concert, Byron led his band in performances of a surprising mix of composers: Stravinsky, Henry Mancini, Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, Earth, Wind & Fire, Sly Stone, and the Sugar Hill Gang. Byron's latest album, Ivy Divey, is dedicated to Lester Young. When in 1999, Byron was voted Clarinetist of the Year for the 8th straight time in the Downbeat Readers Poll, the accompanying article said, "The current that runs through Byron's work is the rediscovery of America." Before we talk with Byron, let's hear a track from his latest album, Ivy Divey. This is Somebody Loves Me. That's Don Byron from his latest CD, Ivy Divey. Don Byron, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Hey, Terry, how you doing?
Why did you want to pay homage to Lester Young in the first few tracks of these CDs?
Well, you know, about 6 years ago, I started really listening to Lester Young really carefully. And I think in that 6 years, some pretty good technique that I had has kind of upgraded itself just by the suggestion of the kind of technique that he had. And I think by the time it came time to make Ivy Divey, I really had something to really crow about in terms of his personal impact on my playing.
What was that impact on your playing? I mean, I don't think of Lester Young. I mean, he's a brilliant player, but I don't think of him first and foremost as like a technician of the instrument.
But see, that's the sneaky black stuff. Like, people like Lester Young and Wayne Shorter actually have more technique than other people, but they find a way to look like they don't have any at all, or that it's not really there, or like where you don't really notice it. Like, they take the focus away from technique while they're making music, and maybe they have a tone that's untraditional or unclassical. A tone that doesn't suggest a lot of technique, and yet it's there. With Lester Young, it's particularly true in the way that he plays large intervals, fifths and sixths. And, you know, when you really study an instrument classically, that's the part of the book that nobody wants to go to, the scales and fifths and sixths and sevenths. And yet that's really where you get a whole harmonic grid by studying all the intervals correctly. And so you can look at harmony and you can look at music in a much more relaxed way, that you have everything covered, all the intervals are really covered. And that's the way he plays. He plays as if any interval is possible, which most people play in a very kind of habitual way. And most people in his era either played the blues in a very habitual way, and they played small intervals, like seconds. Basically, they played up the scales. Maybe they'd play thirds. Maybe they'd play some kind of set chord thing. Lester Young really played into the scales of the chords and away from the tendencies people had for how major and minor voice leanings go. He really showed a real command of the whole instrument while he was playing a chord, so that his playing could be much more unpredictable. And then he used that unpredictableness not so much to create a technical impression, but to create an impression of being very breezy, relaxed, comfortable. It was all put to the service of this emotional output that was pretty amazing. I mean, you know, when he's sad and he plays something, it's wrenching. When he's happy, it's very happy.
Now, on that latest CD, Ivy Divey, you play In a Silent Way from the Miles Davis album of the same name. And in the first part of this track, although the saxophonist on this record is Wayne Shorter, I think you sound really Coltrane-ish. You sound like you're doing John Coltrane on clarinet. I mean, there's this kind of like big, mystical, ascending sound. And it's a kind of sound you don't usually hear on clarinet. It's kind of playing you don't usually hear on clarinet.
Oh, well, thank you. But, you know, that is what I've been trying to do on clarinet all along. So maybe I've just finally achieved it. I think the edge and a lot of the content, both harmonic content and spiritual content of the 60s and 70s, really had passed the clarinet by. And it's been my intent to put that on the instrument. And it's not the hardest thing to do, because playing like Coltrane is really, it's technically ridiculous on clarinet, which is why not too many people attempt it.
Why is it technically ridiculous on clarinet?
Well, just for example, I mean, I'll take the clarinet out here. There are certain basic woodwind fingerings that go on every instrument. And most woodwind instruments will give you a few octaves of that. But the same fingering on clarinet in the lowest register gives you a B natural, gives you an F sharp in the next register, gives you a D sharp in the next register, gives you an A flat in the next register, and gives you a D natural in the next register. And none of them are octaves. None of those intervals are octaves. And so that every time you reach a new register, you're actually, you know, as a clarinet player, you don't really think of it, but when you're trying to really harmonically flesh out the instrument, you realize that there's a different fingering system for every register. It would be like every time you got to an octave on a piano and you hit a C, it didn't mean a C the next time. It meant some other note. So you just have to be incredibly well practiced in your playing of scales to really deal with that. And that's why most clarinetists usually play in the middle register and not too much in a low register and not too much in a high register, because that's the register where normal woodwind fingerings apply.
So if on saxophone, are the fingerings the same in every octave?
In every register, and in even the higher registers, the altissimo, the extreme high registers, can all be fingered with those same fingerings. There's other fingerings that are more advantageous in terms of the stability of the notes. But in terms of the overtone series speaking in a normal way, you can pretty much play those fingerings up and down the instrument.
Do you want to say anything else about your version of In a Silent Way before we play it?
I think it's actually the place where I sound the most like Lester Young, especially once the groove gets started. And, you know, Lester Young used to love to play things like, he would create kind of a sequence of intervals that he'd play repeatedly down a scale or up a scale. And the rhythms would usually cross, so that the first time he played it, it would be on the beat. The second time he played it, it would be off the beat, and then it would come back on. And I do a lot of those kind of motivic things that he used to like to do with scales.
So why don't we play some of the Coltrane-ish part and then hear part of the second part of the piece, which is the more Lester Young-ish part. How does that sound?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this is Don Byron, In a Silent Way, from his latest album, Ivy Divey.
Thank you.
That's Don Byron on clarinet from his latest CD, Ivy Divey. Well, you know, you also do several original compositions on this CD. And the one I want to ask you about is called Lefty Teachers at Home. First of all, you come up with great titles for your compositions, like that one.
Thank you.
But I have a feeling that this composition is actually based in part on exercises?
No, it's based on lefty teachers at home.
What are lefty teachers at home?
They were a couple who was featured in this documentary that I scored, which played on PBS last year called Strange Fruit.
Oh.
Strange Fruit is a documentary about the song Strange Fruit, and it goes a lot into the guy who wrote it, which was a guy named Abel Meeropol. So the two lefty teachers in question are, you know, the teachers union was a pretty liberal kind of group of a lot of people that were involved in the Communist Party and a lot of left-wing politics. And they knew everybody, you know. They knew this guy, they knew Robeson, they knew Abel Meeropol, they knew everybody. And so they sat around and reminisced about different things. And one of the things they reminisced about was the first time that they heard the song Strange Fruit, which they heard at a cabaret kind of situation that was very progressive at the time, with had both black and white performers and patrons. And they argued bitterly about what date they first heard the song, but like to the point of insulting each other. And they really reminded me of couples I'd seen who, despite the fact that other people are around, will argue bitterly. So I tried to put a song against them that would make them look cute, like almost like the way the All in the Family song makes Edith and Archie kind of look cute.
That's interesting. Now, you've got your clarinet with the, would you play the opening figure on that piece?
Okay. Well, it goes on. It kind of reminds me actually of the Dobie Gillis theme. I was just, you know, like the other day I said, you know, that reminds me of something else. And then I realized there was one of the Dobie Gillis themes that's Dobie, da 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 da, Dobie, da 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 da, Dobie. It was just like, you know, it's something that I saw that definitely in rerun. But, you know, I remember almost everything I ever heard.
Well, why don't we hear some of Don Byron's composition, Lefty Teachers at Home, and that's lefty as in left wing as opposed to left-handed.
Yeah, as opposed to left-hand, yeah.
And this is from his latest CD, Ivy Divey. Music from Ivy Divey, the latest CD by clarinetist and composer Don Byron. He'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is clarinetist, composer, conductor, bandleader Don Byron, and his latest CD is called Ivy Divey. Don, I recently saw a great concert that you gave at Symphony Space in New York, and this mm-hmm. was a most unusual concert. You led your band in performances of music by Henry Mancini, Herb Alpert, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Sly Stone, and the Sugar Hill Gang.
And Stravinsky.
And Stravinsky, yes, excuse me. So, I mean, you can hardly think of a more varied repertoire for a concert. And this is all music that you love, which is one of the things I love about you as a performer and you know, recording artist, that you have such really interesting, wide-ranging passions in mm-hmm. music. Let's talk about Herb Alpert a little bit. An unlikely choice, I think, as in Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. Why did you want to, like, play his music and kind of rewrite it in the process?
Well, what's interesting, I think, about people, I mean, to turn the attention away from how crazy I am for checking that out, that music worked for a lot of people, so why is it crazy to look at it? There must be, I think sometimes people think that sometimes things that work for a lot of people are less than, and there isn't some good reason why they worked.
No, wait, I'm going to stop you right there. You were never the, like, demographic for that music? I mean, I'm older than...
That's really not true.
No, I'm older than you, and I bought the record from my father. I wouldn't have bought it for myself.
I bought that record. You know, like, you don't understand. Like, I was in an elementary school band when that was coming down, and that was unusual.
Yeah.
First of all, we all wanted to play that, and we all wanted to be that, and it was the only instrumental music other than Lawrence Welk on television. Just think about what was on television. Just think about what was on television in 1960, like where you could see a musician. And all of those things have impacted me, from seeing, you know, The Flood and all that Stravinsky stuff, seeing Leonard Bernstein on TV, seeing the band on Shindig, and seeing Herb Alpert would have whole specials. Mancini would have whole specials where they did nothing but play instrumental music and all the cats could play. I mean, what's better than that? You know what I mean? When we were in school, if there was something like that happening on TV and you were in the school band, you were good if you could play a phrase of it. If you could go ba-da-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba and you were a trumpet player, oh man, he's good. He could play the Tijuana Brass.
You know what I'd like to do? Let me play just a little bit of a Herb Alpert hit, and then you could tell us more about how this music has influenced you. Okay, that's Herb Alpert, one of the composers that Don Byron recently interpreted at a concert in New York. Don Byron, tell us more about how this music, how Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass influenced your music.
Well, you know, what I respect about it is its precision. I mean, a lot of people think that the only way as a jazz musician I can look at someone being good at what they do is by, you know, how improvisationally strong they are. And Herb Alpert is not a guy that you think about in terms of strong improvising. But I think of him more as a good, almost Baroque trumpet player. Especially, he's very consistent with how he phrases all kinds of things. You know, back a few years ago, I did a record of Bacharach stuff with Bill Frisell. And, you know, me and the other brass players, we had to get serious about what those articulations are. So if you go, you know, like, there's this really kind of crisp, articulated way of playing that he does very clearly. He plays very nicely in tune, and he never fails a melody. He doesn't drop off the end of it so that you're kind of wondering what the melody is. He doesn't wander off. He finishes playing a melody so that any fool that hears that once knows what the whole melody is. It's a very difficult talent, much closer to what a classical musician does, but still a very difficult thing to do.
Don Byron will be back in the second half of the show. His latest CD is called Ivy Divey. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with clarinetist and composer Don Byron. His latest CD, Ivy Divey, is dedicated to Lester Young. It includes songs recorded by Young, two compositions by Miles Davis, and several Byron originals. One of the many pleasures of listening to Byron is hearing how he interprets music that he loves from genres of music that seem to have nothing in common. When we left off, we were talking about a concert he recently gave at Symphony Space in New York, in which he led his band in performances of music by Stravinsky, Henry Mancini, Herb Alpert, Earth, Wind & Fire, and Sly Stone. Now let's get to the Sugar Hill Gang. You performed their music at your concert, and in fact, the three original rappers from the Sugar Hill Gang came on stage with you and did their raps. And, you know, I never really thought of this as like instrumental music, as music that a band would want to play, because what's really front and center are the rappers. And so many rap records have music that's actually sampled from other records. You don't even think of there as being like an actual band in the studio, but there was an actual band for these early rap records.
Yeah, well, one of the most prominent people in that band was Doug Wimbish, who's now the bass player in Living Color. He was a bass player that played on, you know, there was just as big and prodigious a crew for that music as there was for the Motown or the Philly sound. You know, they were a company that was pumping out hits, and they had methods and players and arrangements. And to me, all of the music that the Symphony Space group has done, any of it, you could say, is in the Sugar Hill stuff. You could say, oh, man, you know, there's Earth, Wind, and Fire in that. There's Sly in that. Because there is. They even covered Sly. It was all influenced by that. And really, what the Sugar Hill music was, especially in the early days, was big band funk. That's what it was. Those were big band funk records. And that was the whole point of the whole Sugar Hill evening, was that this early music was coming straight out of the funk stuff from the 70s.
Let me play a little bit of Rapper's Delight, the Sugar Hill Gang's first hit.
Hip-hop, the hip-hop, you don't stop. Rock it out, baby, bubba to the boogity bang bang, the boogie to the boogity beat. Now what you hear is not a test, I'm rapping to the beat. And me, the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet. You see, I am Wonder Mike, and I like to say hello. Up to the black, to the white, the red, and the brown, and the purple, and yellow. But first, I gotta bang, bang, the boogie to the boogie. Say up, jump the boogie to the bang, bang, boogie. Let's rock. You don't stop. Rock the rhythm that'll make your body rock. Well, so far you've heard.
That's Rapper's Delight, and at a recent concert, my guest Don Byron conducted his band playing the music that we just heard and brought on the rappers from the Sugar Hill Gang to perform again some of their hits and lesser-known songs. In the Sugar Hill part of your concert, a lot of people in the audience got on stage and started dancing to the music. I imagine that doesn't happen a whole lot when...
That Symphony Space is not the spot for that.
Right.
No, it's not the spot where you think of the hotties getting up on stage. The hotties are up on stage with the cats in Symphony Space. Sacre bleu.
So, was that fun for you, or did you feel upstaged at all because everybody's going to be watching
awesome.
The dancers?
That was awesome. It was like an old-time Bronx house party. And, you know, like, I don't want to even get into dissing today's rappers, but that kind of real generous MC thing that those old cats do, that's not what the young cats are doing. Just about making a real party happen, making a party happen. They were known for that. They were MCs. And you know, like, to me, the word MC is like in Latin music, when you say somebody's a singer, that's cool, but when somebody's a sonero, they have an ability to entertain and improvise and do things. I think in every culture, there's a special word for that kind of person. Those guys were real MCs, and they really made a party happen at Symphony Space, which is, you know, it's different than that the music was good.
Now, I read that one of the reasons why you studied clarinet is that you had asthma, and your parents thought if you studied an instrument, a wood instrument would help your asthma. That's very counterintuitive. You would think that a woodwind instrument or a brass instrument that forced you to blow would be bad for a kid with asthma because... their breath might be impaired during certain periods. So how did that work out for you? Was it a help or was it a problem?
Well, it was a helper, except I still have asthma. So, like, it didn't really work out the way that we wanted it to. It didn't eradicate my asthma. I mean, swimming and playing a wind instrument at the time were the things that were considered the wise things to get a kid to do. I had no talent in swimming whatsoever. Couldn't even float. Can't even float. So it was of the two choices, and I guess it had been the clarinet because my uncle had owned a clarinet that the family had held on to for many years. And so by the time it was time for me to study clarinet, you know, there was this wooden, you know, nice kind of German-made clarinet that played pretty well, and I played it almost into high school. So I think partially the reason that I chose the instrument was because there was a good instrument floating around.
My guest is clarinetist and composer Don Byron. His latest CD is called Ivy Divey. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is clarinetist and composer Don Byron. His latest CD is called Ivy Divey. How old were you when you started playing clarinet?
7 or 8, something like that.
When you were studying classical clarinet as a kid, what did you envision for your future? Did you think that you would be in an orchestra, you know, in a classical orchestra?
Well, I thought about that, but I had never seen that. And
you'd never seen an orchestra or never saw...
No, I had never seen a black musician in any of the orchestras that I'd ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd seen, by the time I left high school, I'd seen the City Ballet. You know, I'd seen all the orchestras in New York. I'd never seen a black musician in the woodwind section of any of those orchestras ever. And I still have it. You know what I mean? And that's with, you know, lots of black clarinet players and black flute players who've come through all the conservatory stuff and have tried to make it in New York. I still have not seen that. I've seen a Puerto Rican clarinet player who played in the Metropolitan Opera, who's very good, but I haven't seen an African-American clarinet player play one of those gigs. So on the one hand, I would say, yeah, I kind of had that hope. On the other hand, you know, I'd never really seen anybody do that.
So, when you started getting serious about making music your life, what did you think you were going to do with it if you were training for classical music, but you couldn't imagine yourself actually getting a job in an orchestra because no one had ever given such a position to an African-American musician before in the orchestras you'd seen, where did you think you were heading?
I didn't really know. And, you know, when I left the schools in New York, which I had had my fill of, to go to Boston.
To the New England Conservatory of Music.
To the New England Conservatory. At that time, I think I wanted to... My heroes in music were guys who were Latin arrangers. You know, I'd come out of watching the salsa scene of the 70s quite intently, and there were two Latin arrangers, Luis Cruz and Luis Perico Ortiz. And those guys were my compositional idols. And what I wanted to be was an arranger for the Fania. I wanted to write arrangements for you know, recording artists on Fania Records. That's what I wanted to be when I grew up. And so by the time I got to Boston, I could play piano in a group. I could write charts. And I walked in by accident to a rehearsal studio within a month of getting there and just started playing piano in a band. And writing charts for all the bands that came through the rehearsal studio. And that's where I met Edsel Gomez and some of the people that are in Six Musicians now. I met them in that period.
Oh, that's interesting. But of course, the direction you first became famous for was klezmer music, because when you were at the New England Conservatory, you became the clarinetist in the Klezmer Conservatory band.
Mm-hmm.
And so that took you in a totally unexpected direction.
Yeah, I wasn't really expecting that. But, you know, you have to understand that at the time that I started playing klezmer music, nobody wanted to play it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were really no good instrumentalists in klezmer music. Everybody in klezmer music, except for Giora Feidman, were playing like their third instrument, because they'd all come from bluegrass and not playing those instruments. So Andy Statman, that's not his first instrument. Sapoznik, he was a banjo player. So like the Klezmer Conservatory band was the first klezmer band, really, where everybody was playing you know, instruments that they were up on at a classical or near classical level. So we were all kids. We were all making money enough that we didn't have to worry about money. We had this gig, and then we could do all this stuff outside of the school and outside of the band that also educated us.
Since we've been talking about classical music and your classical training, I thought we could play your interpretation of a Puccini aria, Nessun Dorma, which you recorded on your album A Fine Line. Do you want to talk about...
I wish you would play the last cut on there from the Larghetto from the Chopin Piano Concerto.
Oh, we'll do. Tell me why you want to hear that.
That I love.
Okay.
That's my favorite thing that I recorded like that.
Tell me why.
Because it really has the phrasing of Arthur Rubinstein. It really shows an absorption of that. You know, it really shows that passion. You know, there's, you know, like when I came out with klezmer music, people say, oh man, how can he sound Jewish? But to me, sounding Jewish was just another way of sounding European. You know, Jewish music is just another European kind of music. And I really related it mostly to stuff like Weber, which is just kind of very kind of melodramatic kind of classical music. But really, what I work at when I'm playing all these different kinds of European music is my feeling about playing European music. And I would say Arthur Rubinstein and Pablo Casals and all of these guys that like I checked out when I was in high school just trying to be a straight up classical player, they've had a lot of impact on the way that I play.
Okay, well, why don't we hear it? And this is from Don Byron's CD, A Fine Line. That's music by Chopin, as interpreted by clarinetist Don Byron from his CD, A Fine Line. I want to play just a little bit of one of your recordings that I bet most of our audience has heard. So this is from your CD, Bug Music. Charlie's Prelude, and this is something that the John Kirby Band used to play, and you reinterpreted it on your CD that featured John Kirby music and Duke Ellington music. And I think you're probably aware of how much this has been played on public radio. You know?
Yeah, I think actually with the studio where I'm at now uses something from Bug Music as the theme to one of their shows.
Mm-hmm. And This American Life has used the track that we just played a lot, and our show has used it a lot. And I'm just really curious if that has, if that's come back at you in any way, if people, like,
I doubt if I'm going to walk out of the studio and somebody's going to say, oh, snap, it's Don Byron. You know, because I don't look like the person that would create that music to them. I think it's just ended up in a lot of places that I wouldn't expect. It's almost constantly licensed for things, advertising. It was in the movie Serendipity. It was used just last year. There was a Fleet Bank commercial with Derek Jeter where it was used. Uh-huh. Every once in a while.
And you don't get credit for that. I mean, like, even when we play you, like, if we play you for a billboard or something, we don't say, and that's music by Don Byron. You know, so a lot of times when the record gets used, it gets really familiar. And yet,
it's better
people don't necessarily
than
know it's you. Yeah.
It's better than it not being used.
Right. Okay. Okay.
I mean, there's nothing I can really do about that. It's like, you should just be glad that people are enjoying your music and have found some use for it. And hopefully they'll find some use commercially for some other things that I can do.
Well, before we end, I want to congratulate you. You're getting married soon.
Yes, I am. And I found the ultimate woman.
Okay. Is there going to be music at the wedding? And if so, who's playing?
One of the cellists, Wendy Sutter, in the Bang on a Can All-Stars, she's volunteered to, like, actually play some Bach at our wedding. So we might take her up on that. And I might write something. I'm not going to play at my own wedding, but I think I'm going to write something.
Why wouldn't you play at your own wedding?
I don't want to work.
Good reason.
Playing is work. I don't want to work. You know, I'm so happy about getting married. I never thought I'd get married. It's so unbelievable. It's so unbelievable that I want to do it, that I know it's the right thing, that I know it's the right person, that I have no second thoughts about it. It's amazing. You know, when you get to that point where you really feel, oh, well, this is it. This is it. You know, I could chill with this. You know, we even adopted, we got a cat. We got like a hypoallergenic cat that we adopted together. Like, she researched these hypoallergenic Siberia cats. So we're like a family now. It's like unbelievable.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Don Byron's latest CD is called Ivy Divey.